Hello everyone and welcome back to the Daniel Report, where we're taking on the issues of the day with soul. I'm John Iadarola and we've got a lot of news that we're gonna get to today. Weird SNL reference there. Anyway, we got two guests who are gonna be joining us a little bit later on. We've got a candidate we're also gonna be talking about legalization of marijuana in places that have currently been effectively barred from having that happen. We're gonna be delving into the wealth tax, extremely wealthy people on cable news whining about the possibility. And then we're gonna talk about the actual facts. What do people think about a wealth tax? We'll be closing out the show with Meanwhile In. There is obviously so much going on around the world every day, but in particular, this week seems like a pretty feisty one. But before we get to that, we do have to talk about yesterday, the presidential conference on coronavirus. So let's launch right into that. Yesterday, Donald Trump addressed the nation to reassure worried people about coronavirus that he was taking it seriously. Unfortunately, he's Donald Trump, so it accomplished really the opposite of that. Here is a bit of what he had to say about the virus.
There's no reason to be panicked about. But when I mentioned the flu, I said, actually, I asked the various doctors, I said, is this just like flu? Because people die from the flu. And this is very unusual. And it is a little bit different, but in some ways it's easier and in some ways it's a little bit tougher. But we have it so well under control. I mean, we really have done a very good job. Go ahead.
So I don't want to be hyperbolic. I have no interest in fear mongering. And I realize that I've probably burned through a lot of my rage at the president coming across as an effective way to persuade people because he inspires so much rage literally every day. But that was absolute madness, what he just said there. First of all, that he asked a doctor, is it just the flu? Like a child would, but also saying in some ways it's worse. Well, thank you for acknowledging that. In some ways it's better than the flu. Man, that's looking on the bright side. And what I have heard is people who are saying, like Rush Limbaugh, sorry, Medal of Freedom recipient, Rush Limbaugh saying, it's the same as the flu in that the flu is just as deadly. Now look, do a lot of people die from the flu? Yes, inside of America. Is it likely that more people will die this year from the flu than for coronavirus? Yes, I certainly hope that the numbers of a new disease don't rise to match that. A lot of people do die from the flu. That does not mean that they are equally deadly. Overall, you're probably hearing the number perhaps 2.7% fatality rate from COVID-19. That is what we believe is true, but that is not actually constant across all demographic groups. In fact, when you break it down by age, the elderly are significantly more likely to die as a result of contracting COVID-19. And when I say significantly more, I don't mean 3%, I don't mean 4%. For people who are 80 and older, I saw in an analysis inside of China of the first, I believe, 70,000 cases, it was 15% fatality rate. By comparison, do you know the seasonal flu, its fatality rate? 0.1. Now that is still devastating. That still means that thousands and thousands of people will die every single year. But 0.1 and 2%, let alone 0.1 and 15%, those are very different numbers. And so Donald Trump is continuing his campaign of misinformation that hypothetically could result in a lack of proper preparation, either by the federal government or by individuals, and more people getting sick and perhaps even dying because they've been lied to by the president. Another comparison, by the way, of this to other diseases that I saw, it's just a visualization, but I think it's important. And again, we're not trying to fearmonger. We just want to put this in historical context. So COVID-19, the coronavirus has come about. There have been other diseases, MERS and SARS and swine flu that have also spread. It's not the same thing though. And so take a look at this animated GIF of over time, the number of cases. You see there Ebola and SARS at the top after about a week of people being exposed. And you see MERS coronavirus is now starting to go up. It's just about where MERS is at that point. And then look, SARS is way ahead, really. Should we be worried about coronavirus? I mean, we got past SARS just fine. And no, you see the number shooting up, and coronavirus now at the 28-day mark has passed it and is shooting up and is shooting up and is shooting up. And now all of those other diseases, their numbers are being compressed down pretty effectively. And you're gonna see there, I think this goes to day 43. I think maybe 42, caps out at 43,000 cases. We don't have 43,000 cases now, we have twice that about. We have 81,000 cases, which would mean that in a comparison shot like that, those other diseases that spread fears of a pandemic would be condensed down to straight lines. Again, that does not mean that you should be overly scared. It just means that we need accurate information from a president who is not inclined throughout his life to provide it, and certainly in this case doesn't seem particularly interested in doing that. But just in case you've avoided some of the basic information around this, so far 2,800 people have died and more than 81,000 now have been infected by COVID-19. The majority of both the deaths and the infections are inside of China, with numbers dropping down significantly to countries like South Korea, Italy, Japan, and others. Right now in the United States, the US, the CDC has confirmed cases in 6 states: Arizona, California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, and Wisconsin. They've recorded 2 cases of human-to-human transmission among family members. And we're just seeing breaking news today of the first sort of community contraction of coronavirus inside of the United States. And people are saying the reason that that is likely to have happened is the way that federal regulations for screening people for diseases like coronavirus are set up. It's for people who are traveling recently from China to the United States. And not everyone who hypothetically could infect someone with coronavirus fits into that very narrow definition. And it is possible that at least one or more people in America have been infected because of, I would say, at the very least, outdated, if not fundamentally flawed, federal guidelines for that sort of screening. And so let's talk a little bit about money. We need to respond to this. It's going to be expensive. The president asked Congress on Monday for $2.5 billion in funding to fight the coronavirus. More than $1 billion of that funding will be designated for vaccine development. That request has been described by Democratic leadership as anemic and inadequate. I don't know for sure. I can't tell you exactly how much needs to be spent. I know that we did spend more on Ebola, which is a very deadly disease, admittedly, and still a threat in that part of the world. Far fewer cases internationally, of course, which sounds like we would need more money. When you see $1 billion for vaccines, though, I do want you to bear in mind that that huge amount of money that will be spent in developing a vaccine, which is much needed, does not mean that once we have it, you're good. You've got your vaccine. Everyone has their vaccines. We're all going to be safe. That was made very clear when Alex Azar was testifying before Congress yesterday, as you'll see.
Reaffirm, then you're saying it will for sure be affordable for anyone who needs it.
I'm saying we would want to ensure that we work to make it affordable, but we can't control that price because we need the private sector to invest. The priority is to get vaccines and therapeutics. Price controls won't get us there.
Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Because did you get what he said there? He was like, yeah, no, I mean, it would be great if the coronavirus vaccine was affordable, but what you gonna do? Corporations need to make some money and we can't step in. What are we trying to do? Avoid a pandemic? We can't get involved with what these private corporations are gonna do. After we've spent $1 billion to help develop the vaccine, we can't step in. We don't have any leverage. It's not our place really to say that people should be given free or at the very least incredibly affordable vaccines for the coronavirus that Donald Trump is actively misinforming people about, that other authoritarian regimes are lying about the spread of. We're gonna let people not be prepared mentally or indeed physically for it. And then when we have the vaccine, I hope you are saving between now and then. That's what they're saying. It's not gonna be free. I literally think that everyone who is watching the news of this spread thinks that inside of the United States and internationally, when we get it, it will be made available. No, first of all, it might take a year or a year and a half to develop it. Even then, it'll take a long time for it to actually be spread throughout the United States, let alone around the world. And even then, it might not be affordable. And so for poorer Americans, working class Americans, they will then once again, as is so often the case, have to make the decision between safeguarding their health and the health of their family and other priorities that have been put on them by this incredible amount of income inequality that we have. And I want you to understand the intersectionality of this issue with issues that we're talking about in the Democratic primary right now. So for instance, paid sick leave. America is horrendous on average. Some companies are good. On average, horrendous when it comes to paid sick leave. So there are gonna be a ton of Americans who between now and when we're past this crisis, who are thinking about, I don't feel 100%. Should I take the day off and forego that pay? Possibly get yelled at by my supervisor, maybe in some cases lose my job. No, I can't really take that chance. I should probably go in. And they're under an incredible amount of financial pressure to make that sort of bad decision because they will not be protected by the regulations of the federal government that if you're feeling sick, take the day off. Don't go and congregate in a small area with a lot of people. And they're like, thankfully, a lot of people, not most people, a lot of people do have health insurance. And so some of them might be thinking, well, I know that millions upon millions of Americans don't have health insurance, but at least I do. But here's the thing, unless everyone has access to the vaccine, you are only as safe as the least insured person around you, effectively, because they are not provided with what's necessary to stop them from contracting coronavirus, let alone a million other diseases. This is another reason why so many people are getting increasingly interested in single payer healthcare, usually described as Medicare for all. Every day issues that we deal with would be made far more manageable from a health point of view, a public health point of view, and a financial point of view. But especially, it's put in even more stark contrast with the world that we could have when we're facing something like the coronavirus. But I don't want you to think that the government isn't prepared at all. They did announce yesterday, after all, that they're putting someone in charge of that. And that's where we transition to the next part of this. Donald Trump reassured the American people that he was taking coronavirus seriously by putting his top guy, Mike Pence, in charge of it. Mike Pence, noted diagnostician and doctor? No, he was a Republican governor though. And the reaction to it was about what you'd expect. AOC tweeted, Mike Pence literally does not believe in science. It's utterly irresponsible to put him in charge of US coronavirus response as the world sits on the cusp of a pandemic. This decision could cost people their lives. Pence's past decisions already have. She gets into a little bit of what she means there in a follow-up tweet saying, as governor, Pence's science denial contributed to one of the worst HIV outbreaks in India's history. He's not a medical doctor, he is not a health expert, he is not qualified nor positioned in any way to protect our public health. And look, Pence's past ability to influence public health as Indiana governor, the most obvious example of how that can go wrong is that he presided over an entirely unnecessary rise in cases of contraction of HIV when he was governor. He either didn't care or wasn't prepared to stop that from happening. And so many people are rightfully scared that he will approach coronavirus with as blasé an attitude as he did HIV. But his anti-science streak is even worse than that. I want you to take a look at a couple of quotes from an op-ed he wrote. I believe this was in 2001. He said this, time for a quick reality check. Despite the hysteria from the political class and the media, smoking doesn't kill. In fact, 2 out of every 3 smokers does not die from a smoking related illness, and 9 out of 10 smokers do not contract lung cancer. That was not in 1969, that wasn't in 1901. Seinfeld was on the air, I think, when he said, smoking doesn't kill, you dupes, you idiots. And then to buttress that, he cites some numbers. Now, I don't know where he's getting these numbers from, but he says 2 out of every 3 smokers doesn't die from a smoking related illness. It is a bold move to go from smoking doesn't kill to only 1 out of 3 smokers dies from it. That's bold. 9 out of 10 don't contract lung cancer. What about the 1 out of 10 who do, using your numbers? And here's the thing, back in 2016, there was an analysis of his past comments. About 40 million people smoke in the US, according to the CDC. 1 out of every 3 current smokers dying from a smoking related illness, those are his numbers, would therefore translate to about 13.3 million people dead. 1 out of every 10 smokers developing lung cancer means 4 million sick people. So what if coronavirus does kill 2% of the people it infects, or 5% or 10%? Hey, it's better than smoking from the point of view of former governor and now Vice President Mike Pence. And here's the thing, you've probably already seen this going around, it's not gonna surprise anyone, but following the new presidential rule of there's always a tweet following him putting a guy who thinks that smoking's good for you as the head of our coronavirus response, Donald Trump back in 2014 tweeted, Obama just appointed an Ebola czar with 0 experience in the medical area and 0 experience in infectious disease control. A total joke. Yeah, a total joke. Unfortunately, the joke is on us because Donald Trump is our president. Mike Pence is in charge of protecting us from coronavirus and he thinks that smoking's cool. Anyway, with that, we are gonna move on. We're gonna take a short break. A guest is gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Over the past decade or so, more and more Americans now live in a place where marijuana has been legalized, but that does not mean it's universal. Lots of parts of the country currently have total bans even on medical use of it. And so activist efforts continue in various parts of the country to try to create some sort of equitable situation when it comes to access. And one of those activists joins us now. Activist burn survivor of the 2003 San Diego wildfires and VP nominee for the Legalize Marijuana Now Party, Rudy Reyes, welcome to the Damage Report.
How you doing, John? It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you here. And so, look, I guess I live in California, and so marijuana is legal here, and it effectively was legal here even before it was legal here. And so you come from a different part of the country, and you're still part of an effort to try to make that happen. Can you tell us about the candidacy and about the party?
Well, let me see. I'm part of the Legalized Marijuana Now Party. And the idea there is we need to have marijuana legalized, not only for medical, but for its own use across the United States. This drug has been horribly made into a monstrous situation, which it doesn't deserve. There are many people out there who, you know, like me, could have found a medical use for it, which aren't even being allowed. And that's basically the issue.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about it being like sort of made in a monstrous situation, it's demonized. I saw Senator Marco Rubio made a joke about reefer for everyone a couple of days ago. Similar jokes have been made on Fox News. I guess, again, because of the bubble I live in, I feel like we've moved past that. But there are still people who have that, you know, 1990s or 1950s belief of what the drug actually represents. But I'm curious, do you believe that, I guess the tide has come in, the tide has turned on people's view of what the drug actually is and what it does?
I believe that the tide really turned probably about 5 years ago when we started to get about 20 to 25 states legalizing within the nation. We had a big change. And with that change came people starting to realize that this could be an effective medicine.
You know, so tell me about the particular use of your party inside of Minnesota, where you can't have ballot initiatives, which is how it's been legalized in a lot of different states. So tell me about the path over the past couple of decades to try to get it legalized.
Well, the issue has always been, like, you know, California, where what we really did was use the people's initiative and got the people to support it and made a people's ballot. There are other states where that's not possible. So what we're doing in those states is making it so that you have advocates like me approaching and lobbying for medical marijuana and medical patients. You know, there are ways to change the laws. It's just, it's slow. And unfortunately, the majority of my experience has shown me that the politicians are the problem. They, you know, a law can be passed like here in California for medical marijuana, but unless the politicians are willing to step forward and initiate those laws, it's pointless.
You know, so I'm curious, as this Democratic primary is going on, virtually all of them say that they would legalize marijuana. Many of them say they do it on day one. I believe, don't quote me on this, that Mike Bloomberg might be the only one saying that he would not go that far. I guess as an activist in this area, do you trust them on this? Do you believe that if the Democrats win in November, we will have full federal legalization?
Honestly, I don't. And the reason is because there's so much money that's set up against cannabis in general. Whether you're talking alcohol just because they don't want to lose sales, or pharmaceuticals because the same situation, they don't want to lose their sales. Plastics alone are trying to stop us. Paper, there's a big conglomeration of corporations that wouldn't want to see this go forward. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the politicians are very apt to take their money and campaign for them rather than do something which is good for the public currently.
So you believe that this might be one of the areas where they'll say what they think they need to win an election, but it'll be relatively easy for them to turn their back on it once they're sworn in?
Correct.
So let me ask you about your own position as an activist. We've had a lot of candidates on the Damage Report, many congressional candidates, Senate candidates, even some presidential candidates. You are, I believe, the first vice presidential candidate. Tell me about the choice to run specifically to be vice president.
Well, I was asked by this national organization, which the idea is to push it towards a whole national movement. Right now, if you look at it, it looks like it's mostly a Midwest situation with the Legalized Cannabis Now party. But the idea was is to, you know, put out that olive branch to spaces like California, spaces where we have legalization and medical use, and get them on board too. So you'll notice that you have people like me starting to pop up and speak because we need people like me to speak. You know, the population itself has a lot of people that could benefit from this. And unfortunately, we're being led down a pharmacological avenue.
Yeah. And you've said in past interviews that prior to surviving that 2003 San Diego fire, you were not political. Tell me about that transition.
Well, okay. In my fires, I was opened up to the idea of medical cannabis. Before that, I was one of those DARE teachers. I was a 7th and 8th grade math specialist. And after the fires, I was left with 75% burns, lost a finger, and lost an ear. I had to really learn how to deal with my pain management. And unfortunately, in the hospital, I was starting to OD from all the opiates that they were giving me. I was literally turning a green shade color. Mm-hmm. The doctor decided to try a last minute thing and see if I would live on medical marijuana. I did. I was one of their big test subjects. And with that, it made me aware that that was something that we could actually try. Yeah. So I started to grow my own and become my own advocate for this. Unfortunately, the county of San Diego has held a long resistance against medical marijuana. So next thing I know, they ordered my house to be raided. Simply put, I had a illegitimate raid where they came to my door, knocked politely, came in, raided, took everything of valuable to me, and left me with a card from the district attorney.
Wow.
That night, I had a quick decision. Either blow it up in the media or allow the courts to handle it. And if I had allowed the courts to handle it, it wouldn't have came out very positive for me at all. So I went to the media and I did a huge thing and made the police force look bad because, you know, San Diego specifically, they are very pro-marijuana. It's just the politicians aren't. So next thing I know, I had the district attorney contacting me and they wanted to drop all charges. And it made me realize I had rights. We had rights. And that was the big breakthrough. If they were going to be there sitting at that seat making these decisions that were going to go against me personally, it's a political seat. Why can't I run for that seat? So I started to run politically. I ran for my county supervisor seat. I've run for my local mayor seat. Doesn't mean I'm going to win anything. Again, I'm a squeaky wheel here. I'm trying to make sure that other people get their voice heard.
Okay, well, that's awesome. And we certainly support that. Rudy, where can people find out more about your candidacy?
Go to Legalize Marijuana Now. That's one of the main ones. You can find my Facebook page, Rudy Reyes. There's also a Legalize Marijuana Now Facebook page. There's a lot of information out there. It's just a matter of doing your own research and educating yourself.
Okay, Rudy Reyes, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Appreciate it, sir.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, let's touch base with the messaging at Fox News around a possible wealth tax after this. If you've been watching the mainstream media over the past few months, you've heard any number of different attacks on Bernie Sanders coming from all sorts of different directions. His supporters are too mean, he's too divisive, ignore his favorability numbers and all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, we know that for many of these people who are uniformly incredibly wealthy people, this is fundamentally about dollars. Sometimes they're honest about that. Here is an example of Sean Hannity being honest.
Here's the problem. He's going to tax people by his own admission that make $29,000 or more. They're going to get slapped with a 4% tax increase to pay for Medicare for all. He's going to high income earners. They're going to see a top federal rate of 52%, a hike of 15%. Capital gains he's going to raise. He wants a wealth tax. The death tax, 77%. Oh, okay, New York gets another, what, 10%? I think your city gets 3%. The federal government, that means you tax people, they pay their taxes, then you take another bite at the apple with the wealth tax if you were dumb enough to save money. And then when you die, you got to give 90% of your wealth? Don't you think that's legalizing stealing?
No.
You know what I think? No, you should have all that money.
You know what I think?
We should just hand it over to you.
You know what I think unites Republicans, Democrats, independents? Two things. One, too much money in politics. They'd all like to see the big money out of politics. Two, they all think the wealthy are not paying their fair share in taxes.
Okay, so I want you to understand that when I'm saying that he's being honest, I don't mean about literally anything he said in that, and certainly not the graphic, which I'll talk about in just a second, but that his concern is that taxes would go up. Let's keep it real. There, he's being honest. He can talk all he wants, socialism this, communist that. It's just he doesn't want his taxes to go up. Obviously, he's scared about that. Now, the way he presented that argument, he often would say the same thing in different ways to make it seem as if there's more issues than there are. So that graphic you saw scrolling, it had raise the corporate tax rate and repeal Trump tax cuts. But in the Trump tax cuts, they lowered the corporate tax rate. So isn't that the exact same thing? Just ridiculous. But anyway, look, his concern is this is crazy. You can't do this. You can't raise these taxes. And now what you need to understand is in terms of what he's focusing on there, this is a very wealthy person talking about very wealthy person problems to an audience of very poor people who have been bamboozled into believing that their chief concern is the problems of very wealthy people. And so there, he talks about the death tax, which is of course the estate tax, capital gains, the wealth tax. What percent of his audience will ever have to pay a cent for any of those taxes? Is it 1%? Maybe 3? I mean, it's Sean Hannity, maybe 5? But that's it. Those are not taxes that concern regular working class people. And in particular, when you find out what would actually be funded through those taxes, those are things that are of interest to people, unlike Sean Hannity. When it's paying for public colleges, when it's paying for universal healthcare, those sorts of things, he doesn't want to talk about what they would actually be taxed to do. He just wants to fearmonger people into thinking they'll be taxed when the vast majority of them, in fact, will not. That's his news, I guess. The good news is that the American people aren't actually buying it. So when you poll them about, for instance, the wealth tax, that's the most radical of all these taxes, a clear majority of Democrats, 85%, back the proposal, along with 66% of independent voters. Nearly half of Republicans, 47%, say they would support a wealth tax. Because here's the thing, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, they can yell at these working class conservatives all they want, and they will convince some of them, maybe 53%. But at the end of the day, these people know what money they have, and that they know that for the vast majority of them, it isn't wealth that they have. If they're lucky, they have savings. That's what they have. If they're lucky, they can survive an emergency, a car breaking down, an unexpected medical expense, something like that. But they don't have wealth. They're not diving off a diving board into a bunch of gold coins. Sean Hannity can do that. Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, they can do that, but not regular working people, Republican or Democrat. And so, look, they do find in the survey, there is a difference in opinion about a wealth tax amongst different income groups. Those earning more than 75% are slightly less supportive of taxing billionaires than those earning less. But still, they're both overwhelmingly supportive of it. There was another poll, by the way, Reuters Ipsos reported similar findings in a different poll showing 64% of Americans supported a wealth tax. And just to give you the actual information, because of course this was not included in the segment by Sean Hannity. Last September, Sanders detailed his wealth tax that would impose a 1% tax on wealth between $32 and $50 million, with the rate progressively increasing on richer Americans, but still at the end of the day being a very small percentage of their total wealth. Wealth that will continue to expand because their investment income will be larger than it. That is the truth of the wealth tax that is never told. It's not gonna devastate even the extremely wealthy, and it is already overwhelmingly supported by the American people. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break. Another guest after this. across the country, Democrats are facing primary challenges. And that's from, you know, Democrats you've probably never even heard of to some of the most notable in the country. We've profiled many of those challenges here on the Damage Report, and we have an additional fairly notable one today. The challenger to Adam Schiff, no less. This is Silver Lake Neighborhood Councilwoman and congressional candidate in the 20th District of California, Maybe a Girl. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you here. As I alluded to in the intro, you are taking on Adam Schiff, who is one of the most known Democrats, particularly over the past few months with his involvement in the impeachment debacle. So tell me about the decision to run against such a well-known and probably very well-funded Democrat.
Yeah, if not the most well-funded Democrat running as an incumbent. So, as you mentioned, I'm on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council, and when I was elected, I became the first drag queen elected to public office in the United States, which actually came as a shock to me. I would have imagined that there were more drag queens already elected, considering how much we are activists. But the reason I decided to run against Schiff is because I think a lot of people think of him as a progressive because of his involvement with the impeachment, when in reality, he's very much a middle-of-the-road Democrat. He's a moderate, he's a centrist. And here in District 28 in California, which includes West Hollywood, Hollywood, Silver Lake, Echo Park, this is one of the most progressive parts of the nation. And I think that we need progressive representation and not moderate representation.
So that's very interesting that there's the idea of Adam Schiff. He was involved in trying to impeach Donald Trump. He shows up on Bill Maher. And then there's his actual voting record, which is not necessarily a firebrand progressive, obviously. So when you're out there and you're campaigning, you're talking to potential constituents, which Adam Schiff do they support?
You know, it's interesting.
Or do they believe exists, I should say.
Exactly. Going out and talking to the voters, you know, a lot of people have expressed shock that I would even dare to run up against Adam Schiff. But what a lot of people don't realize about Adam Schiff is he's voted for a lot of policies that progressives are adamantly against. He voted just last July to increase funding for ICE by more than $200 million, which I think is despicable in a district that is more than 25% Latinx. Most people don't realize how much of a war supporter he is. He supported the Iraq War in 2004. He supported the Saudi invasion of Yemen. He supported keeping troops in Afghanistan. And literally every military increase that has crossed his desk, he has voted to increase our military spending, which I've always said this, if we can spend nearly $1 trillion a year on the military, we can spend money on things like Medicare for All, for the Green New Deal, for a tuition-free college, and a lot of the things that we actually need here in this country.
Well, you don't have to convince me on those priorities. So you had a Twitter thread recently where you called out a number of the different industries that he's received money from. What is your philosophy on fundraising? Which sort of money are you pushing for and will accept, and which are you rejecting?
So we are running a completely grassroots funded campaign. We are only accepting small personal donations from the people. I don't want to take any money that is involved in any sort of dirty industry. And you know, you have to ask yourself, is somebody that is accepting campaign donations from weapons makers and the defense industry going to keep us out of war with Iran? Do you think that somebody who accepts campaign donations from the real estate industry is going to try to help homelessness? Do you think that somebody that takes campaign donations from insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies is going to be in support of something like Medicare for All? So really, you have to think about what your politicians are saying and look at where their money is coming from and really try to figure out on your own where their loyalty is. Is it with the people or is it with the corporations that are funding their campaigns?
Yeah. Let's jump into your platform. In your campaign materials, you have three key tenets: protect, advocate, and legislate. Can you tell us, walk us through those?
You know, I think in politics, marginalized communities have been left out of the conversation for far too long. So the element of protect really means to protect marginalized communities, to protect women, to protect the LGBTQIA community, to protect immigrants, to protect minorities, to protect the environment. And, you know, those are things that are so important and they're hot topics right now. But again, how can we trust that our politicians are really looking out for us when we don't have representation? And when they're taking campaign donations that are, you know, what we would consider dirty money.
So look, we've talked quite a bit about who's been supporting Adam Schiff. You got the support of a pretty important organization, the DSA LA. Tell us about that.
I was so excited to get that endorsement because, you know, I'm the only progressive Democrat running on the ballot. There are 7 challengers running up against Adam Schiff. And so to get that endorsement really meant a lot to me because it shows that I'm the progressive choice in this district. I was excited to get that. I've also been endorsed by Our Revolution Los Angeles. And, you know, these are the organizations that I want to have the endorsement from. So that was pretty exciting to get that.
Yeah. And look, I want to bring it back to one of the things that you mentioned early in this interview. You said that you were the first ever drag queen elected to an office. Tell me about the decision to run in drag. First of all, was it actually a decision? And what were some of the considerations that you made?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, the reason that I decided to run like this, there's a couple of different reasons. So I am a drag queen, but I'm also a trans person. And so for me to go out like this, it's a very visual representation of the queer community. I think being queer is one of those things that you can hide if you want to. And I want to show that queer people are here. We're not going anywhere. And we are about to have a huge voice in our government.
That's awesome. Where can people find out more about your platform?
You can visit my website, which is maybeagirlforcongress.org. You can also follow me on Instagram @maybeagirl or on Twitter, maybe_a_girl.
Maybe a girl, congressional candidate in the 20th District of California. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. And now, time for news from around the world. It's Meanwhile In. Meanwhile in Botswana, if you're planning on seeing any of their rhinos, you might want to book a ticket now because they are unfortunately and tragically going fast. At least 46 rhinos have been slaughtered in Botswana in 10 months. The killings, slightly under 10% of their entire rhino population, have occurred in the northern Moremi Game Reserve since April of last year. Now, this happens, the killing of effectively almost decimation of their rhino population, despite the fact that they are a protected species in Botswana and fall outside the government's recent decision to end a 5-year ban on trophy hunting licenses, which has largely targeted the burgeoning elephant population. So they do have some protections for this population, but poachers are still able to get access to them and have had a lot of success in doing that. The unprecedented rate of poaching last year, to put this in perspective, prompted the government to warn that the rhino population could be wiped out in the southern African country by 2021. Not 2075, not 2050, 2021. In like a year and a half. And so just bear that in mind. These animals aren't gonna be able to be just like, you know, plucked from some lab afterward if we at some point start to respect and value the biodiversity of our planet. We need to sustain it now while we can. So why is this happening? Poaching is fueled by a seemingly insatiable demand for rhino horn in Asia, where it's coveted as a traditional medicine or as an aphrodisiac and can fetch up to $60,000 per kilogram. An extremely valuable substance, despite the fact that rhino horn is composed mainly of keratin, the same substance as in human nails. Now, just to be clear, that market in Asia will not accept human nails. I worked my way through a couple of my nails before I figured that out. But no, but really, like, it's not magical. It doesn't have any sort of special powers. It's literally not an aphrodisiac. And yet we might lose a species. It will be gone forevermore because some people believe that it has some sort of special power. And that is why these regulations need to be strong. And indeed, in general, I would say a more critical view of trophy hunting as well as poaching is important. But unfortunately, in America, our elites still think one of the coolest things in the world is to suit up, get a big rifle, go over to Africa, have them stake down an animal, walk up and blow its head off. That's the world we live in. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in the UK, they're attempting to stop some of their children from developing severe issues later on in life with new regulations on how football is practiced by children. Children aged 11 and under will no longer be taught to head footballs during training in England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. The new Football Association guidelines for coaches also puts limits on how much heading older children should do. So why is this an issue? Why are they changing the ability of young kids to head footballs? Glasgow University research showed former footballers were 3.5 times more likely to die from brain disease and 5 times more likely to die from Parkinson's disease. I mean, these are, like, again, any sort of study like this, you're gonna of course have to have follow-up studies. You have to be very sure that the connection is there and that it is showing what it appears to be showing. But those are very strong impacts. And obviously, in this case, very easy to avoid impacts as well, hypothetically. But that does not mean that everyone is supportive of this move. There was a quote I saw on the BBC by former Tottenham Hotspurs midfielder Jamie O'Hara, who said, "Heading a football is a skill that is essential to becoming a footballer. How do they propose they learn this if they're not allowed to head a ball?" I get that concern. And bear in mind, they're not saying in all football across all ages, no one's gonna be able to head a ball. It's literally just in training for the young kids. And so I guess hypothetically, you could have a future world in 5 or 10 years where the hot up and coming football talent doesn't know how to do that one particular thing. But I would say if we're concerned about the effect it's having on children, shouldn't we be concerned on the effect it might be having on adults who are heading far more balls? Shouldn't those adults be concerned about the effect it's gonna have on them? I know that every time we talk about the effect that sports have on people's bodies, those athletes obviously have a financial impact to do what they're gonna do, regardless of the long-term health impacts. But this is literally killing people, and it seems like it's avoidable. Meanwhile, in Mexico, there is a women's event planned for next month, and it's fueled by growing disgust with a spate of high-profile femicides. It's gained ground on Friday as Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said public servants could participate. Sorry, I read the whole name out just in case any presidential candidates were watching. But he is saying he is not going to strike out at any female civil servants who want to participate in what is believed is going to be a very wide scale woman-led strike across the country. He says he'll respect the strike, there will be no punishment, but he didn't openly support the event and asked women to take care, quote, not to be manipulated. And look, I am by no means an expert on Mexican politics in general, let alone the way issues like this might be manipulated by different parties and might be used in the short term by conservative political parties to make inroads against the current leadership. That said, there are a lot of issues facing Mexican women that they are thankfully organizing against, and so I'm of course supportive of that. To give you some basic information, the strike is scheduled for March 9th. Promotions began circulating this week on social networks under the slogan, "A Day Without Women." It comes amid public outrage sparked by the murder of a 7-year-old girl and a woman skinned by her partner. And there's an advertisement saying, "Not a woman in the streets, at work, in schools, in universities, or shopping." Read a call to strike being distributed on social media. Again, look, do the research for yourself in terms of how different groups might be using this. But these are obviously worthy issues, and in general, activism of course is a good thing. And so I am glad that at the very least, some women perhaps in high profile government positions in Mexico will be freed up to be able to be supportive of it without worrying about the future of their career. So look, those are the main stories that we want to talk about today. There are other obviously important international stories that we will be talking about, both on the Damage Report and also likely today on the main show. Notable stories include Iran's Vice President of Women and Family Affairs, Masumeh Ebtekar, has contracted coronavirus. Now, we've said before, Iran is currently it's one of the high profile countries that are being affected the most in terms of deaths from coronavirus. Now it has struck one of the women at the highest levels of Iranian leadership. Earlier today in our live video, which if you don't already follow us on YouTube, you can go to youtube.com/thedamagereport to do so. We talked about a new update, seems like an important one on the supposed Bolivian election stealing of October. Researchers in the New York Times looked into it. And no, the initial storyline about what had happened there turns out not to be true. That has had untold and continuing political and indeed physical chaos that have resulted from that storyline, which was largely accepted without question. And I just wanted to give you updates. We've been talking about the violence in India. It has now led to 200 injuries and 40 dead. and it's barely being talked about. Our president just returned from a trip there, and I haven't heard him utter one peep the fact that dozens of people were killed on the streets while he was there. So I did want to just let you know, that's an odd transition, I acknowledge. But we often encourage you to, if you listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, please do that. Continue to write reviews and put a 5-star rating there. We got one from Papa Smurf recently who said, John and all of his weekly anchors are amazing. JR, Brett, and Emma from time to time give you honest, fact-based news. They're saying time to time on them being here, not on them giving fact-based news. Haven't seen Brooke in a while, but she's great too. She certainly is. What's even better is on top of the research, you know it's true because they're actually willing to admit fault. While it's not always the news I want to hear, it's the news I need to hear. Perfect for your lunch break. Highly recommend Papa Murph. Thank you so much for that. As throughout the week, the main show today is going to be JR, Emma, and myself. We're going to be doing both hours, so we look forward to seeing you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.